President Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour. We've got a great guest this evening, and we are going to be talking about a topic which he is probably the foremost expert in the world on, and that is the Federal Reserve and this fiat financial system that we are operating under, and the implications of what is going on right now in the world and what future is in store for the Federal Reserve. Our guest is an author. He is a documentary film producer, and he is a world-renowned author. He is also the founder of Freedom Force International, a group that is seeking to bring a solution to virtually every problem that we have on the planet. People from all over the world joining this group, as well as the founder of the Reality Zone, which is a information outlet on the internet that deals with lots of different topics and brings people all over the world together. Between the Reality Zone and Freedom Force International, this gentleman has done quite a great feat in bringing people from other countries and people from all walks of life together for the same goal, and that's to bring peace, love, and prosperity to the planet, as well as move forward in a sensible way. With that, I'd like to introduce tonight's guest to my listening audience at bbsradio.com. He has been on Evident Footprints before when I was with the old network, and we welcome him to the new one, where I can assure him that the folks are very spiritual, very educated, and very sympathetic to this cause. And with that, I bring to you Mr. G. Edward Griffin. Mr. Griffin, how are you this evening?
Well, I'm doing very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You are a hard man to get, but I am so grateful you could make it to the show this week. Now, we have a lot of things that I'd like to talk about, but I'd like you to give a little bit of background to the listening audience who, for whatever reason, may not have heard of your book, the famous one. If you would, and you don't have to spend too much time on it, but just give them an idea of what you wrote, and I'm talking about The Creature, of course, and what propelled you to compose that masterful piece of literature.
Well, thank you, Don. Of course, The Creature from Jekyll Island is it's not what it appears to be or what it sounds to be. It sounds like it might be a mystery story or something related to The Creature from the Black Lagoon, or a sequel to Jurassic Park or something like that. But actually, it's about the Federal Reserve System. And the reason for the title, as you know, Don, is that the Jekyll Island, although it has a very mysterious sound to it, and people think of it as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, it has that kind of an aura to it. Jekyll Island is a real island. It's off the coast of Georgia, and it was on that island back in 1910, that the Federal Reserve System was created. So it was highly significant because it's unusual, first of all, that something like the Federal Reserve would be created on a private island off the coast of Georgia instead of in Washington, D.C. Most people, including myself at one time, I thought that the Federal Reserve System was an agency of the federal government, that it was created by Congress for the sole purpose of policing the monetary and banking system of America for the benefit of the American people and all of that. So when I found out that the Federal Reserve wasn't created in Washington, D.C., but on an island, my curiosity meter went all the way up into the red. And then when I started to research a little bit further, I found out that not only was this meeting conducted on a private island, but it was done under conditions of extreme secrecy. The people that went very much out of their way to conceal the fact that they were going. They denied it for quite a few years afterwards. They said, oh, no such meeting ever took place. When they went there, they adopted code names when they traveled together so that the servants on the train wouldn't know who they were. When they got to this island, you see, the island was privately owned in those days by a small group of billionaires from New York City. It was a resort island. It was called the Jekyll Island Club. And it was where people like J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller and their business associates and their families, that's where they went to spend the cold winter months to get away from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was quite a place, and still is, by the way. You can visit it and see those mansions that they lived in there. But the center of social activity was in a beautiful wooden structure. They called it the clubhouse. It's still there, too. It's beautifully preserved. You can visit that today. And it was in that clubhouse where this meeting took place. And when they got there, they even made sure that the servants that normally serve these people were let go for that week. They had temporary servants for the specific purpose that they didn't want the servants to know who was at this meeting at that clubhouse. So these are the kinds of things that went on. And I thought, this is really strange, because I knew that when things are done in secret, there's usually something to hide, and I thought, why would they be hiding this? What was it they were trying to hide? Well, that was what started me down this path, Don. I wanted to find out what it was that these people were trying to hide, and I did find out. And so I wrote the book, and that's really what it's about. It's what they were hiding and why they were hiding it and what the implications were to the monetary system of America. And what the implications still are today to us, to you and to me, and it's certainly playing out in the last few months, because everything that's happening today in the way of the meltdown of the economy was set in motion back in 1910 at that meeting on Jekyll Island. So that's, in a nutshell, that's the reason I called the book The Creature from Jekyll Island. And what I really found out as to what it was they were trying to hide, let's cut to the chase on that. The Federal Reserve System was sold to the American people as a way of controlling those big bad bankers in Wall Street. There was a lot of concern in those days about the financial control in the hands of a small group of very wealthy financiers who owned and were astride the giant banks in New York, the giant insurance companies, the investment firms, and they literally controlled the credit and the flow of money in the United States. Mm. And everybody was concerned about that, especially when some of the banks were going belly up. There were runs on the banks. Banks were making dishonest agreements with their depositors. They were saying they would hold their deposits safely in the vault, and they could have their money back anytime they wanted. The depositors were assured of that. And then when the depositors ganged up and said, well, okay, now we want our money back, the banks had to admit, no, they didn't have the deposits in their vault. No, they couldn't keep their agreement. So they had to, you know, close the doors on the bank. That's what they call the run on the bank. And so there was a lot of concern about banking and fraudulent banking, and people were losing their savings, and it was a mess. And so there was a lot of pressure on Congress to draft a bill which was going to clean up this mess. And they were going to control those bad bankers, and it was all going to be in the hands of the people through the elected representatives of the people. And that was the theme, you see. Well, as it turned out, that the Federal Reserve Act was written on Jekyll Island away from the prying eyes of the public, away from the press, away from just about everybody, because the people who wrote the bill were those big bad bankers that the bill was supposed to control. The men that actually went there and drafted the Federal Reserve System were the epitome. They were the bankers. They were the ones that the country was concerned about. And they had decided, look, They said, all right, the public is clamoring for some kind of legislation to control our industry. So what do? Do we just wait for them to come up with something that we don't like? No. Mm-hmm. We will take the lead. We will be the ones that will draft the legislation. We will be the ones that will call for reform. We will be the ones that will make sure that the public is satisfied because they got the bill that they want. But we will be the ones who will write it so that it won't do any of the things that the public wants. And in fact, it will do all the things that we, the bankers, want. And that's what I discovered when I finally got, you know, past the surface of you know, a cursory examination of the topic.
Yeah.
The Federal Reserve System was created by the top banks in the United States with a lot of influence from European bankers as well. And what they created, Don, was a cartel. The Federal Reserve System is not an agency of the federal government. It was created by an act of Congress. It was a bill. They created a corporation, a special corporation, through an act of Congress. But the embodiment of that corporation was a cartel. It's no different than a sugar cartel or an oil cartel or any other kind of banana cartel. This happens to be a banking cartel. It was created by the banks themselves. They went into Congress and they said, look, we want our cartel agreement, which we have drafted up for our benefit. We've phrased it in such a way to make it sound as though it's for the protection of the American people, because that's what the American people want to hear. Now, this is our cartel agreement, and we want you to pass it into law so that everybody has to abide by our cartel agreement, or they will go to jail. Now, there in a nutshell is the quickest and most accurate description of the Federal Reserve System you're going to find, and you won't find it in the textbooks.
Yes. Now, if I may interject something here, and thank you for that wonderful explanation, by the way. And you did that within 5 minutes. I've never heard it done so fast.
It's pretty amazing. It normally takes about an hour to get through all that.
Well, as I mentioned to you on the show the last time you were on the air, of course, our listeners on BBS did not hear that show, although we probably have some who used to listen to the show on the other network here tonight. So for some people, bear with me for a moment. I had... But you had sparked my interest in how these guys actually pulled this off in the beginning. Once it was identified that most of the people who were involved seemed not to be Americans. Actually, this is not an American bank per se. This is run through the web. It's connected through the web of the European bankers. And Warburg himself, Paul Warburg, was a manager for the Rothschild banks in Paris and London. And his brother Felix was managing the banks for them in Germany, in Hamburg, and also in the Netherlands. So I became interested in following their trail, and I was able to show that they came into the country illegally, claiming they were Americans as early as 1903. So there had to have been some bribery taking place with INS officials at Ellis Island, and that's where I found most of the documentation to back it up. And it wasn't just the Warburgs, but Harry Sachs was involved, James Loeb. I was finding the most ridiculous statements being made by these people that either, number one, they were Americans, or number two, they had never been to the United States on subsequent visits. So there was a lot of chicanery going on.
Oh, there certainly was. I think you're talking mostly about the Warburgs. And although at the time that Paul Warburg became became involved at least in the creation of the Federal Reserve, I think he was a naturalized American citizen by that late date, was he not?
Well, he claimed in 1911 that he was in the District Court of New York.
Mm-hmm.
However, he didn't put in the time that you had to put in to become a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
He had spent all his time in a foreign country.
Yes.
Obviously, money facilitated that.
Yes.
And I'm sure... I'm 100% positive that a judge was bought out. Now, to me, this whole thing, based upon its unconstitutionality, is really illegal.
Yes, well, you see, that, I think that's the important point, isn't it? It's not that that one of these seven men who created the Federal Reserve may not have been fully a citizen, at least not correctly so. The question is not whether they were American citizens, but what they did, you know?
Yes.
Even if they were all foreigners, for that matter, but they did the right thing, it would have been interesting. It would have been okay. But the issue here is not their citizenship, but what they did, the creature they created, and the fact that they got the Congress completely bamboozled, and I'm sure in some cases purchased, so that Congress, which itself did not have the constitutional authority to create money based on debt, gave that power to the Federal Reserve System. Well, they didn't have it to give, and nobody questioned it, you know? So now all of a sudden, here is a group of private bankers. They formed a banking cartel, and the government gives them a piece of paper, and they call it a law, and the law says that this group of bankers can now create the nation's money, and they can create it out of nothing. It's an amazing feat.
And that authority was taken away from the U.S. Treasury, which I understand was the sole entity with the authority to make money and to issue money.
To issue money, or actually to, yes, to issue it, to coin it, and to determine its value. But there was a restriction. They could not just create it out of nothing. They couldn't just issue IOUs. It had to have something behind it. And once it was taken out of the government side and given to the banker's side, then even that restriction was removed, and now they started to use fractional reserve banking, which means that there was nothing behind the money. First, there was maybe 50% of the money was backed by something tangible like gold or silver, and then it was 40%, and then 30%, and then 20%, and, of course, today it's 0%.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Now, If I may put a plug in for your book, I created a page on my website. I actually have a book section where I recommend books of many of my guests. And yours is first on the list, in fact.
Well, thank you, Don. I appreciate that.
And, well, I want to encourage the listeners to go to my website, directlightproductions.com, and click on the books link at the top of the page. And it'll take you right to Mr. Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And, you know, I was thinking, they had the Jekyll and the Hyde in there, didn't they? Anyway, I put some quotes up. I thought it was interesting, the quotes that you had from the testimonial section.
Oh, yeah.
And the first one reads, "A superb analysis deserving serious attention by all Americans. Be prepared for one heck of a journey through time and mind." Ron Paul, publisher-editor, Ron Paul Report, member, House Banking Committee. I thought that was quite synchronistic.
Yes, well, I admire Ron Paul for his principled stand on not just money, but he certainly did have always has had a principled stand on money and banking, but on everything involving our government. But, yes, I was very, very honored to have him endorse my book.
Well, I'm sure that is an honor. You've honored me by making me a member of your Hall of Honor page.
Well, you've earned it, Don. You're doing exactly what Freedom Force advocates that we all have to do, not just sit around and complain about things and mumble about how bad they're going and just read another book and become more informed, but you're out there, you know, doing something about it. You're trying to spread the word and get people organized and take back the power centers of society. If we don't do that, then we're just going to be the best educated people in the world that you can find in the concentration camps.
Yes, exactly, and I'm totally in agreement with you on that. Now, going back to this topic, but bringing it more up to date, someone somewhere once calculated or determined that no society under a fiat money system or a usury system lasted more than 100 years. And we are in our 95th year of this monster or this creature from Jekyll Island, the Federal Reserve. what do you see happening from your perspective now, having written this and studied this for such a long time?
Well, it's not good news. When I wrote the book, which is, 1994 or something like that, I devoted a couple of sections toward the back to a scenario, a pessimistic scenario, where I thought the country would go. And I'm sorry to say that just about everything I wrote in a fanciful way, almost like a novel, is actually unfolding. And that's not because I'm really a smart guy or anything. It's just because I was able to see the forces that were already at play, and it's just like constructing a chart or a graph. Mm-hmm. If you see the points and you see a line going in a certain direction in a straight line, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to project that out a few more years and see where it's going. And that's pretty much what happened. What I saw when I wrote the book originally was that the politicians and the bankers did not really give a damn about the country. They were determined to, on the banker side, to maximize the economic benefit that they could squeeze out of society and the power that would give them, even over the political institutions. And the politicians who played along with that were totally focused on what they could get out of it. You know, living the life of a highly paid politician, riding around in limousines and taking junkets all over the world, and it's pretty heady stuff. And it seemed to me that it was clear that this is what they really were focused on. And they learned to give good speeches, telling the voters what they wanted to hear. They spent a lot of time and money conducting sophisticated polls to find out what it was that was eating away in the breast of the American people, what worried them. And then they stood in front of a mirror and practiced saying, yeah, we are concerned about inflation, or we are concerned about terrorism, or we are concerned about unemployment, or we are concerned about inflation, or whatever it is that the American people were truly concerned about. They'd stand in front of a mirror, and they became now equally concerned or more concerned, but they didn't really give a damn about any of that. Their only goal, for most of them, was to get elected and to get their, you know, to get into that that cushy position. So I saw that very clearly, and then I looked on the other side, and the American people didn't seem to be much more virtuous. They cared about is just let's make some more money. They didn't have time to take an interest in any of these things. They were too busy pursuing the materialistic pursuits. And they were naive enough to believe these politicians. They really like to believe their politicians are sincere. I mean, they understand that you go to a football game and you expect to see the quarterback do something deceptive, you know, to try and to get the ball across the goal line. They expect deception in business. They expect it in sports. They expect deception on a board game, a chess game. They expect it everywhere, except in government. They think, well, once a man goes into government, then they suddenly become saints, and they're not capable of deception. And they really look with scorn on anybody who questions the sincerity of these people. So I looked at the American people, and it seemed to me like they just didn't care, or they weren't smart enough, and I thought, well, there's nothing going to stop this locomotive. The banks are going to continue, and the politicians continue expanding the money supply, because that's the way that they you know, they aggrandize their power and their wealth. They're at the tap. They're the ones that turn the tap on and get the money flowing out of the pipe. They're right there to catch it first, and then they pass it around to the others who are very grateful. So I could see that there's no reason for them to stop. And I saw the control for the media, and the media which would tell people the most blatant, flagrant lies, and the public would believe it, swallow it whole. And I just said to myself, this graph is going to continue to go on a straight line. Unless we see something, which I don't see then, I didn't see then, this is going to go right straight toward the culmination. So what did I see on this graph? Well, I saw the growth of government on a straight line. Every year it got bigger and bigger and bigger. I saw the shrinking of American liberties and privacy every year, getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I saw that the American dollar was losing its value every year, less and less and less. And so I projected all of those lines, and I got to the point where I could see that coming up in about probably less than 10 years from now, or in that range, government will be total. We'll have totalitarian government. Liberties will be zero, which means everyone will be a serf or a slave. And the money will be gone. It'll be no longer even used, because people won't even use money. They'll be given everything that they want, food, clothing, shelter, in return for being obedient. And that's what I saw. And I'm sorry to say that it is unfolding before our eyes exactly that way.
Well, I agree with you, and I want to pose some questions in relation to some paths that I've been following in respect to what you just said. Have you ever heard of an organization called the Office of the, let me preface it, the United Nations Office of International Treasury Control? Have you ever heard of that organization?
No, I have not.
Okay. I came across it through some very interesting documents that were sent to me by someone that thought I would really sink my teeth into this, and they were right. You can actually Google UNOITC, and you will come up with an organization that supposedly is being run through the authority of a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ray C. Dam. Now, have you ever heard of that name?
No, I have not.
Okay. According to this website, Dr. Dam has been given an education from age, well, let's say he achieved his doctorate degree at the age of 16, which is quite a feat in and of itself. And then
yes, that's right.
The story is that he was trained by the United States and the British, as well as a couple of countries in Europe, in the banking industry, and that he was going to be the trustor of some, let's say, the world's gold. And we're talking about the Hirohito gold, the Sukarno gold, and the Marcos gold, or what eventually became the Marcos gold, and possibly some other unknown massive amounts of gold deposits that are in Swiss banks and some other locations around the planet. The story underground is sort of that we have no gold in Fort Knox. Our gold has been gone probably since 1933, and whatever it is they use for the props that they set up for the pictures that they show us to make us think that there's the gold in that fort is beside the point. What's coming out is that massive amounts of gold, which are supposed to have been deposited in banks like UBS, Zurich, are not there. That the certificates are there. They're supposed to mature this year, and these are under the guardianship of Dr. Ray C. Dam, D-A-M. Now, Dr. Dam, the story goes, lives in Cambodia. And to me, this just smacks of the drug industry and the money laundering that we know is going on right now with these massive amounts of trillions of dollars. The hypothecated derivatives and hedge funds. Anyway, Dr. Dam, according to the Senate, there's a document, and I've seen a copy of this document. It's a nice red, white, and blue type of brochure, the same colors as the Project for a New American Century document that came out before 9/11. And Dr. Dam supposedly has a Senate security level 3-5 clearance. And if you are not of that stature, you cannot meet with him, you cannot speak with him. You have to go through his representatives. He has an attorney that represents him in Thailand. There was one that used to represent him out of London and the Netherlands, and he's deceased. Now, whether that was natural causes or not, I don't know. What is interesting is that this group tried to buy MG Rover at one time, but was unable to do so. Yet he supposedly commands large sums of real estate holdings. We're talking about mortgages and private loans in Chicago, in New York, in Toronto, in various parts of the world. And the missing gold that he is guarding has been secreted in sunken ships and caves up in the mountains in countries like the Philippines and probably Thailand or Cambodia, all of the remote areas. Some of this money is being guarded and administered by people in Indonesia. And you're watching the gold prices skyrocket right now. And, of course, they do this for their own benefit. It's another means through which to make money, is to drive the economy down and raise the price of gold. They make money either way. They're making it by the methods that they're creating it out of thin air and then giving up part of our infrastructure. It's probably some 37% to 40% of our western United States is owned by these people secretly, that we don't know about it. But this is coming to light. So I thought I would throw that your way to see if you'd heard about him, because this is
starting. Well, no, I haven't heard about him. And, you know, I've heard stories like this for many years, Don. Very mysterious people and gold hoards in the Philippines and so forth. I've been hearing stories like that for probably 30 years, but nothing has ever come of it, and I don't know what could come of it. I don't know where all of this goes anyway. If this guy, Dr. Dam, is sitting on all this gold, what's he going to do with it? And how did he own it? How did he come into possession of it? And what good does that do us? You know, all these questions come to mind. I don't know. If you're on top of the information, I'm glad to hear that. I'd like to learn more about it.
Yes. Well, there was a document now that supposedly gave him the authority. There were two documents. One was through the Gold Commission, and it was called the Washington Panel. It took place in 1995 or 96. And my understanding is that it ran maybe from 96 to 1998. Prior to that was the Green-Hilton Agreement, which took place in Geneva. And this was from 1963 to 1968. Based upon the Green-Hilton Agreement, President John F. Kennedy had decided, and this was part of his demise, to go back to a gold-silver standard and have the U.S. Treasury print the money and do away with the Federal Reserve. And for that, that was one reason why he paid with his life. Is he was coming up against these bankers and the secret plans that they had in the Green-Hilton Agreement. Now, if you try to find this through the National Archives, they will tell you the document doesn't exist. But I've got other documentation that shows that it does. We just haven't been able to get a copy of it yet.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, you probably remember that I have a lot of doubts about the theory that JFK was suddenly becoming a constitutionalist in terms of money. I mean, his whole career was in the other direction, and he was a graduate of the London School of Economics. He was a Fabian socialist. He was on record many, many times early in his political career as advocating the exportation of gold out of America so that America wouldn't be a major player in the gold market, because that stood in the way of a new world order. JFK was definitely a new world order guy. Mm-hmm. He just happened to be on the other side of the tracks. He had some very powerful enemies in the CIA and some very powerful enemies in the mob. But I don't think his enemies were the Federal Reserve System. But, you know, if you have documents that can prove that, I would really be interested in that.
Oh, okay.
I've never seen anything like that. I know there's a lot of theory about it, and, of course, the Internet is alive with all of this. And people quote each other as though that proves it. But when you try and run down to the original documents, I've never seen anything like that.
Well, when you yes, I'm inclined to agree with your view on Kennedy. We have to remember that the organized crime folks and a lot of other people, including the intelligence communities, were benefiting from the drug industry, which was a big one. I mean, that was their cash cow. And how the money was being spent and what programs were aligned. You know, he didn't really want to go into Vietnam. I know that. And they did. They wanted him.
Of course, yeah. Kennedy was, well, you know, in American politics, it's pretty clear if you just take a good look at it that we have the same dichotomy or the same division within American politics that we have in the world. We've got the so-called right versus the so-called left.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the people that seem to align with the Leninist position and those who align with the Rhodesian position. And you know, you can see it everywhere in the world. Well, that's right in American politics between the Republicans and the Democrats too. But Kennedy was clearly aligned to the left. And the rest of these people were aligned to the right. And, of course, you know, my feeling is that they're both right and left wings of collectivism. They're really not that much different. They
mm-hmm.
both want a new world order. What they fight over is who's going to run it. And but anyway, the CIA was clearly what we would inaccurately call the right of this. They hated the communists, and they thought that Kennedy was soft on communism. He didn't want to fight those wars. He didn't want to oust Castro. He wanted to talk to Khrushchev. You know, he wanted to negotiate. The military and the CIA hated that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the mob hated him and his brother for other reasons. But I'm not an expert on the JFK assassination, but I have to say that the evidence that has come out in the last couple of years is so clear in my mind, so convincing, I just don't see how anybody can deny it.
Yes. And it's no coincidence that they went after his son when his son had announced his intention to run for office. He hadn't declared what office. But the interesting thing behind his, I believe that was an assassination, much like his father's. It was different circumstances, but much of the evidence was repressed, and it's leaking out. But he had come across a document that basically spelled the whole assassination out for him, and he was prepared to launch an investigation into this. So there were a lot of threats that he posed to the status quo, to the Bush family, to the Clintons. He would have run against both of those families together, and he probably would have won hands down.
Oh, yeah, he had a lot of... He had the Kennedy name, the charm, and, you know, people just love the Kennedy name. They think it's Camelot, you know. They don't really know why. It's an emotional thing. But they liked his smile. He had a good speechwriter, and he said a lot of good things. He sometimes didn't follow up on those good things. But, you know, Americans don't care what their politicians do as long as they say the right things. That's all they remember, their words.
Yes, and it seems like they remember when they hear what they want to hear.
Exactly.
So
that's
what they get.
Yes. And so all politicians, not just Kennedy, but all politicians become experts at that tactic.
Yes. Now, another futuristic question for you here, and of course this would be highly speculative, or maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong in presuming that. This rumor that we are already experiencing the Amaro, that the Amaro is being minted and that they are going to start putting this on the market, and that the Bank of America is going to become the central bank, do you have any opinions about any of that? And what validity is the Amaro going to have if it's starting from nothing? Other than that, they would combine Canada and Mexico's gross domestic product to our value, which is nothing plus nothing plus nothing, if you ask me.
Well, yes, there are two elements to that question, Don. First of all, the rumors about the coinage being already minted or printed, and whether the Bank of America will be in the stride of all that. I don't know anything about that. Those are rumors. I've heard them. I have no opinion about them. My guess, without any further information, is that at least half of those rumors are false. I just don't know which half, because the rumors always are like that. And sometimes I think people out there just delight in starting rumors just to see how far they'll go with the gullible community, you know, especially the patriot community. Very gullible sometimes.
Yes.
I've seen more fantastic, weird ideas get circulated like wildfire among the patriot community because it just fits. They say, aha, I knew it, and they don't question it at all. So I think there are people out there that just get a kick out of seeing, you know, how far some of these things can go. But I just don't know. But I do know this. I do know that the MRO is planned. I do know it's very much on the drawing boards as far as the New World Order elite are concerned. They've been talking about this for decades, that their ultimate goal, of course, is an international currency, a global currency. But they have said long ago that they didn't think that the peoples of the world would readily jump from their national currencies or their national sovereignties into a true world government. They wouldn't surrender it. They wouldn't want to blend the American culture with the culture of Africa or Asia, for example. But they said, therefore, let's move it in steps. Let's create regions where the cultures and the languages are more similar. We can move the world into regional governments and regional groupings and regional monetary systems, regional military units, and so forth. Then after they get used to that for 10 or 20 years, then we'll merge all of those into a true global system. That's been their strategy all along. And so you can see it unfolding. The first move was the European Union. A lot of people said, they'll never get Europe to amalgamate into one government. Well, it's happening right before our eyes. It's practically done. And they got the euro. Some of the countries are still holding out, but that will wither away in time. They can't hold out forever. It's a one-way street. The arrow goes in, but it never comes out. The barb doesn't allow it to come out. It can only go in further. So we've seen it happen in Europe, and now it's happening in the North American Union. And they've been talking about it for many, many years. And the monetary unit, the MRO, is an important part of getting everyone into this regional government. And I think the plan is to let the dollar deteriorate so far that it really will no longer be a dominant currency anywhere in the world, much less in North America. The Canadian dollar already, I think, is looking stronger than the American dollar. Of course, the peso isn't looking too good, never has. But if the dollar continues to crumble, and they seem to be working very hard to see that that happens, I can see the American dollar and the peso being about equal not too far down the line. And at that point, of course, people will be crying here in America, what's happened to our monetary system? You got to do something. And they'll cry to the same people that wrecked the monetary system in the first place. They'll turn to the same slimebag politicians and, you know, all of the bureaucrats in Washington that did this to them, and they'll say, we want you to solve this problem. And, of course, they'll say, thank you very much. We're waiting for you to ask us to do that. And then they'll introduce the MRO, which is the next step in this evolution toward global government and the New World Order. So I think what they're planning to do, Don, is they're planning to create so much economic misery here that the people will demand an MRO, and they'll be told that that is the solution to the problem. And, of course, as you intoned a moment ago, it won't be. It'll be just more of the same, but the gum-chewing public won't know that. They'll say, oh, thank you very much. We have a new monetary system. Isn't it pretty? Look at the pictures. And for a while, it'll seem like their purchasing power was up a little bit, but then it'll continue to go down because the MRO won't have anything behind it either, and there'll be no gold or silver, and so the North American Union government will start creating it as much as they need to purchase whatever they want, and the process will continue.
And it might be just a front so they can move forward with the RFID chips. You know, this might just be something that they're putting out there to get us not to pay so much attention to that.
Well, it all goes hand in hand, doesn't it? There are so many things moving at the same time. It's not just money, although that's a big part of it, but it's the surrender of military sovereignty. It's the surrender of sovereignty over our educational system. They're trying to make sure that the United States is totally divided culturally, economically, and language, everything you can possibly think of. They do not want a united United States, a solid United States. They want it broken down, weak, and in great need of help, so that whatever international solutions are offered will be accepted with great gratitude.
Yes. Now, another question. This is more recent. I suppose you've heard about Barack Obama's global tax proposal, which is going to be up for a vote, I think, this Thursday, where the United States is going to have to pay a global tax to the rest of the world, as if we're not giving enough money away as it is.
Well, that's collectivism for you, you know. It's from the wealthy to the poor, and isn't that the wonderful thing, the Christian attitude? Isn't that, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, as Karl Marx said? And there are just lots of people that gobble that up.
Well, any predictions? Do you think they're going to pass this, or is this going to be...
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. I find it hard to believe that they're going to pass that, but then... when I take a look at those guys that are going to be voting on it, I keep thinking, you know, I bet they will. I don't know. I hadn't even thought that all the way through. I wouldn't be surprised if they passed it, because it's supposedly the humanitarian thing to do. And, they don't care as long as they come out looking good and they can say, well, I care. I care about people around the world. I care about the hungry. I care about the sick. I think America should carry its share, its part of the load. And we can afford it, you know, and that'll sound good to all the useful idiots that don't realize, you know, what they're really getting into. That's got nothing to do with caring or helping anybody. It has to do with creating a total collectivist system in which the international rulers will have their hands in your pocketbook and determine how much money you're allowed to keep at the end of a day's work. That's what it's all about.
Well, I would like to see the list of what the other countries are contributing to this global tax.
Well, it wouldn't make any difference to me. I don't care what they're contributing. I don't think that anybody at the United Nations, or even in Washington for that matter, has a right to tell me that I have to be charitable to somebody that I don't want to be charitable to. I want to pick my own charity. I want to pick the people that I want to help, not that somebody else thinks I should help. They don't have the right to do that. Outside of government, if my neighbor came to me and said, look, I have decided that you need to contribute $25 a month to the Boy Scouts. And I said, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your opinion, but I'd rather give it to the Girl Scouts. And so he said, no, you have to give it to the Boy Scouts, because I've got two neighbors here that agree with me, and we outnumber you. So we're going to outvote you. I don't think that's right. They don't have the right to do that, and they don't have a right to give to government to do that. If I can't force my neighbor to do something against his will, I can't give elected politicians the power to do that either. You know, it's very simple, very simple.
I'm inclined to agree with you. I was successful at provoking a bit of anger out of you.
Yes, I do get a little frothed up when I think about these things, because it's not just because the principle is so stupid and so obviously wrong. It's because there's so many good people out there that buy into it. They just don't think it all the way through, and that's what really frustrates me.
Yes, that brings me to maybe my final point here. In all of what's going on, of course, we don't hear a word of the truth from the media. We have double and triple sets of books that they're running the country on, and they're putting the money into their own pockets and into the pockets of their cohorts in the, not just the military-industrial complex, but the drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies, they like to be called, the oil cartel, and in fact, the whole planet is really run under the thumb of the oil cartel. And this incessant war that we deal with, and the false pretenses under which it's going. Do you see a miracle on the horizon, or is it? I know your intentions, and I don't mean to insult you by asking this, but what do you feel in your heart? What do you feel in your spirit? It might happen.
Yes, Don, I do see not exactly a miracle on the horizon. I see a transformation. I see a reversal. I see a very bright future. The only question is, how far away is my horizon? It's pretty far away, but it's there. Most people, when they think in terms of the horizon, they're thinking in terms of the next election. We got to get this done by the next election. 2008 is our last chance, they'll say, to turn this thing around, and I couldn't disagree more, because it's not going to get turned around by 2008. I mean, there's just too much momentum going in the other direction. Even if you assume that, let's say, for some miracle, Ron Paul might actually be elected president of the United States, what can he do? He'd be surrounded by his enemies. He'd be surrounded by collectivists who would do everything possible to block anything he wanted to do. And people in the Congress, in the Senate, in the judiciary system, in the military, all of the bureaucracy that would be working against him. And then you have the state levels and the county levels and the city levels. You've got this collectivist mentality embedded everywhere in our system. Putting one man in the White House, does anybody really think that that's going to change the nation? I'm all for it, because it would be a tremendous message. It would be a beacon. It would be a bugle call that might waken some people up, but by itself, it's not going to change the world. But nevertheless, if you change your horizon from 2 years, or in this case, a year, and you look in terms of a couple of generations, and I know that's nobody wants to wait that long, but don't forget our enemies have taken 100 years to capture control of our country. They started at about the turn of the last century, and they just patiently, gradually moved into all of the power centers of society. And they just didn't get there quickly, but they got there slowly and methodically. We can do the same thing in reverse. And that's, as you know, that's what Freedom Force International is all about. We are building that movement right now. And so, yes, I'm very encouraged. I do see a change on the horizon, but I have to realize that we're looking at the long view of history.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought up Freedom Force, because I was going to close with that. I want to tell all the listeners out there that if you want to join with some folks of like mind who are not sitting on their rear ends with a bag of potato chips and a beer watching American Idol or Paris Hilton on television, on CNN and Headline News, by all means, pay a visit to Freedom Force International. Do you want to give out your contact information?
Yes, it's very simple. It's freedomforceinternational.org. ORG stands for organization. So it's freedomforceinternational.org. And as the name suggests, it truly is international in scope. In fact, Don, you'll be happy to know that we just added a couple of more flags this week. We now have members in 57 countries.
Yes, I saw that. That's great.
It is fantastic, because you know what we're facing here is not just unique to America. It's everywhere in the world. And there's a great power, I think, that's going to develop out of this international unity. And for those who are afraid that we're internationalists and want to give up our national sovereignty, no, not at all. What we're talking about is not internationalism in that sense, but in terms of building a true international brotherhood among men and women all over the world who have the same concept of freedom. And that's an affinity to what we call the creed of freedom. So anybody that's interested in really doing something about this battle has to have a vision. what are we fighting for? It's not just what we're fighting against, but what is our goal? So when you come to Freedom Force International website, one of the first things you want to do is turn to the section which describes the Creed of Freedom. That's the compass. That's the gyroscope that keeps us all pointing in the right direction. We all are in total agreement on that.
Well, that's a beautiful message, and with that, we have to close. You can assume I'm going to invite you back again.
Well, it would be a delight to have you do that, Don. I thank you so much.
And I'm not going to wait so long this time, okay? So, if your schedule allows and developments warrant, if something happens and you think you need to get a message out to folks, please don't hesitate to get in touch with me, and we'll bring you on to give an update.
That's very good. I'll remember that.
Okay. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. Our special guest this evening was author and archaeologist, by the way, documentary film producer G. Edward Griffin. Maybe next time we'll talk about archaeology a little bit.
Oh, that would be a delight.
Okay. And I should have mentioned that up front, but it gives us something to talk about the next time. Folks, thank you so much for listening in. Please pay a visit to freedomforceinternational.org. Also, go to my website, directlightproductions.com. Check out the book section. There are links there that will take you directly to the purchase point of Mr. Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. You really should read that book. It's earth-shattering, to say the least, and mind-bending. And it reads like a detective novel as well. Mr. Griffin, thank you very much again. My best to Joan, by the way.
I'll pass that along, Don.
All right, thank you.
And thank you very much. Good
night. It's been our pleasure.
All right, good night.
Folks, okay. Good night, folks. Peace, love, and light, and we'll see you tomorrow night. Our special guest will be Judy Andreas. So long.
Robin Avery.